This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK. This podcast is sponsored by Wise, the app for doing things in other currencies. If you're sending or spending money abroad, you should use Wise. You'll have up to 40 currencies in the palm of your hand. Wise gives you the real exchange rate, which means you'll spend less on fees and more of your money gets where you need it to be. Download the Wise app today. Or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from our studio in central London, I'm Celia Hatton. There were a lot of nerves before the British Prime Minister arrived in Washington for his first meeting as leader with Donald Trump. Keir Starmer was under pressure to convince a sceptical US president to commit to Ukraine and European security. Other sticky issues like potential tariffs and differences over Gaza also hung in the air. The stakes were high, but the visit that began a couple of hours ago seemed to begin on a positive note. The Prime Minister gave Mr. Trump an invitation from King Charles for an unprecedented second state visit to the UK, and Mr. Trump said the invitation was accepted. They then held closed-door talks. In the past half hour, the two leaders emerged to begin a press conference. First, President Trump spoke. He told reporters that peace between Moscow and Kyiv would either be fairly soon or not at all.
Our approach is basically common sense. As I said, so many of the things that we do are based on common sense. If you want peace, you have to talk, both sides. As I discussed with Prime Minister Starmer, the next step we're making is toward a very achievable ceasefire. We hope that that can happen quickly because thousands of young people, in this case, we're not talking about Americans, we're talking about Ukrainians and Russians are being killed every week, thousands. And it's a rough battlefield. It's a flat piece of land and the bullet only stops when it hits somebody. And this week, I saw the reports and I don't even want to say what they are, but thousands of people, young, vibrant people died. And we want to stop that. Senseless. Should have never happened. This will lay the groundwork for a long-term peace agreement that will return stability to Eastern Europe and hopefully ensure that such a terrible war will never happen on European soil or, for that matter, anywhere again.
Keir Starmer then spoke to reporters.
Mr. President, I welcome your deep and personal commitment to bring peace and to stop the killing. You've created a moment of tremendous opportunity to reach a historic peace deal, a deal that I think would be celebrated in Ukraine and around the world. That is the prize. But we have to get it right. There's a famous slogan in the United Kingdom from after the Second World War. That is that we have to win the peace. And that's what we must do now. Because it can't be peace that rewards the aggressor.
That press conference just wrapped up a few moments ago. But let's get some analysis on this key meeting from someone who understands the inner workings of these things. Dr. Leslie Vinjamuri is director of the US and Americas program at Chatham House, a London-based think tank. She joins us live. Leslie, a lot covered in the press conference. Can you reflect first, differences still existing on Ukraine?
Clearly differences, but you know, there was such a concerted effort by both the Prime Minister, which I think is less surprising, but also by President Trump to put those differences, you know, behind them for this press conference, and also for the meeting that preceded. So I, you know, they we know they're there. We know that there's a question about, you know, what measures will come into force for enforcement of a peace deal if it's agreed, when it's agreed. That there are lots of debates and divisions over, you know, the details, which are very significant. What role will the U.S. play? Will there be a backstop? But they really made every effort to put, you know, the strength of the U.S.-UK relationship in the front view of this audience, and to signal, you know, I think Prime Minister Starmer handled this, I have to say, brilliantly. You know, from the detail, which is extremely important in this case, of providing a letter from the King saying that they'd like to see a state visit, as well as a visit to Scotland, was initially put on the table. Very important signaling and really aligning. So I think that, you know, those are the standouts. At the same time, Prime Minister Starmer was very clear about, you know, about Britain's view, its support for Ukraine, its support for a deal that's just, that those deals are very important. But he essentially, you know, endorsed President Trump's position, which is, you know, that the deal comes first, and then you talk about enforcement, the very clear commitment to sequencing this and really, in some senses, kicking the very tough issues down the road. That kicking the can down the road strategy is, you know, classic one in diplomacy when things are very hard. It doesn't play very well here in Europe, where the threat and the insecurity that's felt obviously from Russia, but now from a very uncertain and disruptive U.S. leadership, it couldn't be more front of mind for most people here, as you well know.
I mean, just focusing on the relationship between the U.S. and the U.K., it was a bit surprising, frankly, to hear Donald Trump reference the idea of a trade deal and saying that he thinks the U.S. and the U.K. could end up with a trade deal that would make tariffs unnecessary. He seemed to be going to great lengths to try to make his visitor feel very comfortable and to smooth things over.
It's really true. And I don't think anybody would have anticipated that. I mean, anybody who remembers the first Trump administration remembers that every single time, you know, the UK government kept asking for that free trade deal and eventually, you know, sort of gave up and learned not to ask anymore. But it seems to, you know, be back on the table. I'm sure it will be a very different kind of deal than perhaps, you know, a starting point negotiation. But just the fact that at this moment, you know, we're not even 2 weeks from Vice President Vance's, we're almost 2 weeks from Vice President Vance's speech at Munich that really shocked Europe and transformed the entire sense of urgency about the state of affairs between Europe and the U.S. and between U.S. and Russia, of course. And suddenly here we are with this press conference, and we're not only talking about a deal where the U.S. and the U.K. seem to be so aligned. I mean, to listen to Prime Minister Starmer name, you know, the U.S. and the U.K. are number one and number two, and to run through the list, remarkably, universities and then Gulf follows very quickly. But then to end with that comment about a trade deal, I mean, look, as we all know, with President Trump, what matters is what follows. And, you know, it's as, you know, likely that the sort of glory of the visit quickly becomes more complicated. But right now, it does look like there's been a huge amount of thinking and preparation on the part of the UK that's gone into this visit. They've clearly warmed President Trump to them. I suspect a lot of people have been working behind the scenes on this. And frankly, in a phenomenally difficult moment, bravo to the people that have pulled this off.
Leslie, just looking forward briefly to tomorrow, when we're expecting Volodymyr Zelensky to visit the White House. We've just heard Donald Trump saying that he thinks that it's going to be a very good meeting tomorrow. He was asked on his comments on Truth Social, calling Mr. Zelensky a dictator. He appeared to say that he couldn't believe that he'd even said that. You know, what can we read from this? Is he really trying to row back his comments on Zelensky?
You know, I sometimes think that President Trump forgets that we all read his posts and talk about them on the radio and television, and people are aware, because he's very, very effective as a leader at speaking to very different audiences. He speaks to, you know, wealthy technology leaders and talks about deregulation and tax cuts. He speaks to people at his rallies, and he's talking about, you know, those rich people have done you wrong, as well as China. And the signaling on Truth Social is, you know, for one audience, but it plays right back at a press conference that's for a very different audience. And everybody's sort of letting it pass and hoping that, I think tomorrow is likely to be a very nice meeting.
Leslie,
again,
we'll leave it
the
there.
The devil's in the detail.
Thank you very much. Leslie Vinjamuri is director of the U.S. and Americas program at Chatham House. Now, the Hollywood legend Gene Hackman, his wife, the classical musician Betsy Arakawa, and their pet dog have all been found dead at home at their home in New Mexico. Hackman was 95 and Arakawa was 64. Two of the couple's other dogs were found alive, and lots of questions are being asked about what happened, but the fate of the dogs is being suggested as a possible clue. Now, before we get into what happened, Gene Hackman is being remembered for his varied and long Hollywood career. He won 2 Oscars and a host of other nominations before securing a new legion of fans for his portrayal of the supervillain Lex Luthor in the 1978 Superman film.
It occurs to me that a 500 megaton bomb planted at just the proper point would
destroy most of California. Millions of innocent people would be killed. The West Coast, as we know it, would
fall into the sea. Bye-bye, California. Hello, new West Coast, my West Coast. Costa del X, Lutherville, Marina del X, Otisburg.
That clip from Superman. Well, let's hear from the BBC's Peter Bowes in Los Angeles. I asked him for more details on what we know about the circumstances around Gene Hackman's and his wife Betsy's death.
Well, yes, and the circumstances are still mysterious to us. After initially saying that there were no signs of foul play, the authorities are now saying that the circumstances are suspicious enough in nature to require a thorough search and investigation, a thorough search of their home, and that is continuing. Although they are still saying that there are no signs of foul play. The sheriff, who's just given an update, said that and emphasised that the investigation is still at its preliminary steps, but did say that it's not normal to find 2 people deceased in a home. And he said that was what was so concerning. There was also, as you mentioned, a dog that was in a kennel in the home, also found dead. There were 2 other dogs at the property outside that had apparently had access to both inside the home and outside. They were fine. The bodies were first spotted by workers at the property, apparently doing some pest control work, and they were outside, could see inside, and alerted a security person in the neighbourhood who alerted the authorities. And really, that's where we are at the moment, that the authorities are continuing to investigate. Clearly, there'll be toxicology tests, there'll be post-mortem examinations of the bodies, and the sheriff's saying that at this stage they're not ruling anything out.
Peter Bowes speaking to us from Los Angeles on the deaths of Hollywood legend Gene Hackman and his wife, the classical musician Betsy Arakawa. Coming up, a BBC special report about people who were forced to work in scam compounds, who are now free but stranded in Myanmar.
The conditions we are in is very hard. We are sleeping on the floor. The toilets are very messed up by now. The food, they serve food twice a day, but the food is not sustaining us, not much. But we are not complaining about that at all. We just need to leave this place because we are suffering beyond comprehension.
That's coming up in 15 minutes' time. First, our headlines this hour. President Trump and Britain's Prime Minister Keir Starmer say they've had productive talks at the White House with the focus on Russia's war against Ukraine. And Mexico has extradited almost 30 alleged drug gang members to the United States, including two founders of the brutal Los Zetas cartel. You're listening to NewsHour. To Turkey now, and a momentous announcement from a man who's been in prison in solitary confinement for the last 25 years. Abdullah Öcalan told the members of the Kurdish militant group he founded, the PKK, to lay down their arms. In a statement, the 75-year-old said there was no alternative to democracy in Turkey, and he asked the PKK to begin a process to dissolve itself. This could mark the end of a four-decade violent struggle for Kurdish independence in southeastern Turkey. Gunul Tol is the director of the Turkey program in the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C.
Every actor involved in these negotiations have their own reasons. So if you look at it from Abdullah Öcalan, the PKK's jail leader's point of view, he has his own personal reasons. He is in his late 70s and has been in jail for 25 years. And as part of the agreement, he could be moved out of his solitary cell and granted better prison conditions. But more importantly, Turkey's sustained military operations, both inside Turkey and in the PKK's stronghold in northern Iraq, have significantly weakened the PKK's operational capacity. So the militant group has been unable to stage large-scale attacks inside Turkey. And also in northern Iraq, it's found its capacity to attack Turkish targets from northern Iraq diminished. And if you look at it from President Erdogan's point of view, he has a significant problem at home. He won't be able to run again in 2028, and that's when his term will end. And he needs Turkish parliament to call for early elections or a new constitution to be drafted. But he does not have the parliamentary majority to do any of those. So he needs the support of the pro-Kurdish party in the parliament to be able to stay in power beyond 2028. So that is the domestic driver.
Do you think it's possible, too, that we might see some members of the PKK disagree and maybe we'll see the birth of some splinter groups?
That is certainly a possibility. And remember, this is a very fragile arrangement. Although Öcalan did not say this in this statement, I think it's fair to say that both the Kurds and the PKK are expecting the government and President Erdogan to take steps to address some of their concerns. And if the government fails to do so, it's easy to see the PKK resuming the fight. And we've seen that before. This is not the first attempt by Erdogan and the PKK to reach an understanding. This happened before, and the last time was in 2013 when Abdullah Öcalan asked the PKK to withdraw from Turkish territory, and they did. But soon after, the fighting resumed, mainly because President Erdogan did not hold up his end of the bargain. And we can see a similar scenario unfolding.
So last question, how optimistic are you feeling right now that this will lead to something lasting?
Ending a 40-year war that left 40,000 people, that is certainly something to be celebrated. But again, we are talking about a fight for democracy and human rights. The PKK is the result of that fight. The PKK emerged in the first place because of Turkey's democracy deficit. And the Kurds took up arms because they want to be granted rights and they're looking for a democratic opening. And I don't see in Erdogan a window of opportunity for democratic reform.
Gunul Tol from the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Now, soundtrack to a coup d'etat is one of five films nominated at the Oscars this weekend as Best Documentary. It looks at American and Belgian involvement in the politics of the Congo at the end of the colonial era. And unusually, it relies heavily on jazz music to tell that story. Vincent Dowd spoke to the producer.
The theory behind the new documentary is that in the early 1960s, the US government used cultural visits to the Congo and elsewhere to disguise and divert attention from intelligence operations.
One of America's most popular emissaries gets a warm reception as he arrives in the troubled Congo on a State Department-sponsored goodwill mission. Louis Satchmo Armstrong arrives in truly royal style.
Recordings by Louis Armstrong, Dizzy Gillespie and others make soundtrack to a coup d'etat a great listen. But at the core of the Oscar-nominated film is the death of Patrice Lumumba from June 1960, Prime Minister of the Congo, who was shot dead only months later.
Lumumba's stormy career was checked by Colonel Joseph Mobutu. As Lumumba's followers raised the threat of civil war, the news came that he had been slain.
Many alleged then that America and the colonial power Belgium were complicit in the death, fearing Lumumba as a dangerous radical. The film's producer is Rémi Grelletti.
Lumumba and his assassination and the plot around that was the centerpiece. But to tell that story, you need to tell it like holistically. The US, the CIA in particular, are plotting with the Belgian to overthrow and eventually assassinate Patrice Lumumba. But that means speaking about the minerals of DR Congo, that means the Cold War, the jazz and the jazz ambassadors.
Can't conceive it, can't believe it, but that's what they Slave no longer, this is Freedom Day.
Does the inclusion of the jazz, is it partly there to make it more palatable to a general audience who don't know a huge amount about African politics?
I think eventually it does, and it works very well in that sense. The idea behind the use of jazz was that jazz and those artists, like those jazz men and women, were a real part of that story, you know? Louis Armstrong was sent to the Congo, and he was touring the Congo at the end of 1960, which is a moment where basically the country is the equivalent of a civil war. And so it's about how they become almost a character to that story, you know, the jazz and what was happening at the time, politically speaking. I think that makes one, actually.
One character we meet in archive film is André Blouin, a key Lumumba advisor. Her daughter, Eve Blouin, believes the film is already bringing forgotten issues of African decolonization to a new, young audience.
I said to myself, finally, it is happening. This movie, I think, is overdue, should have been done a long time ago, and I'm very happy that the whole team of Soundtrack did such a fantastic job.
Yves Blouin thinks the film's new approach to modern African history gives an emotional depth.
So much intensity. I think I was moved since the first minute of the movie and I never stopped. It was extremely moving for me to see all these parameters together in one piece of art.
The film is a highly unusual mix of heavyweight politics and gorgeous music. We'll see what happens at the Academy Awards, but producer Rémi Grelletti says the film had an effect even before its Oscar nomination.
In Belgium, it was released in early September of last year, and it's been very successful. The press was great. I think Belgium overall is more ready than it used to face that dark chapter of its history. There's a willingness to learn more.
Vincent Dowd, a soundtrack to a coup d'etat, is one of five films nominated at the Oscars this weekend as Best Documentary.
This podcast is sponsored by Wise, the app for doing things in other currencies. If you're sending or spending money abroad, you should use Wise. You'll have up to 40 currencies in the palm of your hand. Wise gives you the real exchange rate, which means you'll spend less on fees and more of your money gets where you need it to be. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur einen Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.
Hello, I'm Robin Ince.
And I'm Brian Cox, and we would like to tell you about the new series of The Infinite Monkey Cage. We're going to have a planet off.
Jupiter versus Saturn!
Well, it's very well done, that, because in the script it does say wrestling voice.
After all of that, it's going to kind of chill out a bit and talk about ice.
And also in this series, we're discussing history of music, recording with Brian Eno, and looking at nature's shapes.
So, listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. Fighting in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo is continuing. Today saw explosions and gunfire in Bukavu, recently seized by the Rwanda-backed M23 armed group. Thousands of Congolese refugees have fled into neighboring Burundi, causing a humanitarian crisis. Nomsa Maseko reports from Burundi.
Despite a life of difficulty and displacement, a church service here at the Chishimera transit camp on the outskirts of the capital Bujumbura has brought people together. Nearly 2,000 people were transferred to this camp after they fled their home country, many of them women and children. Families have been left devastated. Men have been killed and women raped. A 50-year-old woman told the BBC she was raped by several men who covered their faces in her village in Goma while she was trying to flee last month. Another woman, Charlotte Odile, lost her husband after he was shot dead by rebels. She never got a chance to bury him. The heavily pregnant woman and her four young children were helped by Burundian troops to find shelter.
They have raped a lot of women, especially those who were found on their farms, because we live next to a forest where the rebels operate. I escaped with several women, and along the way, I could not trace where they were. And up to now, I don't know if they're still alive or dead.
Another overcrowded temporary camp for the displaced has been set up at Rugumbo Football Stadium. There's not enough food or water here. We met Clarice Kasindi, who lost her three-year-old child while crossing the Rusizi River last Saturday.
One of my children was lying on the raft in front of me while I held three others besides me. We had many other people in the raft, and when we reached at the middle of the river, the raft broke into two and my child was swept away. M23 are really making our lives very difficult. Even if I want to go back, I will be forced to start from scratch. They have stolen everything that we left behind.
UNHCR official Bridget Mukango Ino has said the number of refugees is expected to increase as the M23 continues to advance.
For Burundi, this is the first time in over 20 years for Burundi to receive this large number of people. The last time they received this many people, it was around the early 2000s. We need to support this country in receiving the refugees, to improve the condition of those who are coming so that there's no clashes between even the refugees and the host communities.
Meanwhile, back at the camp, these children are playing, oblivious of the tragedy that is unfolding in their own country that will affect their lives forever.
Nomsa Maseko reporting.
I'm Celia Hatton and you're listening to NewsHour on the BBC World Service. We started the programme with that key meeting between the leaders of the US and the UK. Lots of smiles on display when Keir Starmer and Donald Trump met at the White House, with the US president saying he has a great relationship with Sir Keir. A good start, it seems, but how might that relationship unfold? Both men are poised to be in office at the same time for years to come. Let's hear from Woody Johnson. He's the billionaire heir to the Johnson & Johnson pharmaceutical fortune, a longtime friend of Donald Trump and a Republican Party donor. He has a diplomatic history, too. He was the US ambassador to the UK during Donald Trump's first term. We spoke before the White House meeting, and I asked Woody Johnson how significant the meeting was for President Trump.
It's significant in the fact that we've had such an historic special relationship with the UK for so many decades. Yeah, and his mother was born in Scotland and the Hebrides Islands, and his meeting with Her Majesty and all that. But how significant is the visit right now? I think it's more significant to the current prime minister, perhaps. First of all, you've got all the issues on the Ukraine that you're going to have to scroll through where the US and where the UK may differ, which is not necessarily a bad thing. You know, we have trade, we have the Ukraine, you have Brexit and the will of the people in terms of separating from Europe. So I assume that those will all be talked about today when the two of them meet.
You said you don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that the two have differences. You served as the ambassador to the UK during Donald Trump's first term.
Yes.
Do you think it's regular? You know, you mentioned the special relationship. Is it expected that the two will have differences, or do you think they're heightened differences at this point in time?
I think there may be heightened differences at this point, but that will be, we'll see whether those can be worked out.
Do you think that Donald Trump will be impressed by Keir Starmer's decision to increase defense spending to 2.5% of GDP in the next couple of years?
I think he'll be very unimpressed. He's talking 5% now. I mean, that's just a number that he's thrown out. But yeah, I mean, going from 2.2 to 2.5 in a couple of years will not impress the president. And you just give you context, look at what he's done in the last 30 days. I mean, he's moving at a very, very fast pace right now. And so I think he would want to encourage other countries, and particularly the UK, to move too.
And so what do you think that Keir Starmer needs to do to build a good relationship with Donald Trump?
I think he has to understand where Donald Trump is coming from. That's pretty easy to do if you look at what he's done and what he did 8 years ago. The handwriting on the wall is very easy to determine. And so the prime minister will, I think, benefit by helping the president in what he's trying to accomplish.
This meeting between Keir Starmer and Donald Trump is the first meeting in what will probably be a very, long, years-long relationship. For Donald Trump, does it really come down to money, to commitments on defense spending, or is he looking for anything else?
Oh, I think he's looking for a lot of things. You know, he'll talk about free speech. He'll talk about the restrictions on trade with the U.S. on an agricultural level. And unfair trade practices of Europe in general. I think the president's announced a lot of those that he's planning to remedy. I think the immigration issue will probably come up. It should be a very interesting period of time.
Let's talk about Ukraine. You have been, yes, a very vocal supporter of Ukraine over the years. Your wife is of Ukrainian descent. Your NFL team, the New York Jets, has made a $1 million donation to Ukrainian relief,
right,
efforts. And you've even said that the U.S. continued support of Ukraine is a matter of upholding America's leadership role in the world. But you're also a longtime close friend of Donald Trump. How do you feel about his apparent shift on support, U.S. support for Ukraine?
Donald Trump And my wife, who's 100% Ukrainian, will agree with this 100%, wants to stop the killing, both of the Russian young men and the Ukrainian young men and women. And discontinuing this war for another year or another period of time does not make any sense to him or to my wife. So we want this war to conclude. And we're hopefully working towards a solution between the U.S. and Russia.
Okay, so you can stop the killing with a ceasefire, in theory, but moving towards a long-time peace plan that will ensure that the killing doesn't restart in a few years' time, how do you speak to the president about that?
The president's got his own opinion on how to do that, and that will come out during the negotiations with Russia.
I just wonder about your relationship, because you have a very unusual relationship with Donald Trump. You're a member of his inner circle. You have been close friends for decades. When you sit down for conversations with him on this topic that you and your wife feel quite strongly about, do you feel that he's open to having an open conversation about it?
One of the things you learn if you've been a friend or an acquaintance of Donald Trump for the last decades is he is the most open and receptive individual that I've met. I mean, he's open to any idea, and he'll listen, and then he'll make his opinion. He wants to figure out a way to solve this for the Ukrainian and the Russian people. He does.
What do you make of the mineral deal on the table that's being negotiated between the U.S. and Ukraine?
Well, we'll see what it looks like on Friday. But the U.S. has put a lot of resources into this, and I think that Trump Trump wants to eliminate wars and conflict. So there has to be a cost to both sides. And this would be very good for the Ukrainian economy anyway.
You've said there must be a cost to both sides. Why should Ukraine pay a cost when it was invaded by Russia?
Well, I'll let the politicians argue about that.
Woody Johnson served as the U.S. ambassador to the U.K. during Donald Trump's first term. Thousands of people from all over the world are currently stranded in Myanmar after they were freed from scam compounds. Many had been forced to work there, carrying out complex phone and online fraud operations on behalf of highly organized criminal gangs. Thailand began an operation earlier this month to try to shut down the compounds, which have proliferated along its porous border with Myanmar. They cut cross-border power and phone links, causing the armed groups that were supporting the scams to start freeing the workers. However, with so many nationalities involved, Thailand is struggling to process the workers and has halted their movement across the border, leaving them in makeshift camps with very limited food or access to running water. Our Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head is at the border and sent this report.
I'm standing beside the Mui River, which divides Thailand from Myanmar. And at this time of the year, it's little more than a muddy stream. But every time I come back here, I'm astonished by the amount of new building you can see over on the other side. That's in Karen State, one of the poorest and least developed parts of Asia. These buildings are featureless blocks in closely packed rows. They are the notorious scam compounds, which have made their mainly Chinese crime bosses immensely rich by defrauding people all over the world and using trafficked labour. Well, now thousands of workers have been freed over there, and yet they're still struggling to find a way home. Earlier this month, 260 from 20 different nationalities were ferried across the Mui River and taken to be registered in Thai army trucks. Another 600 Chinese freed from scam centres were taken directly to the local airport and flown, zip-tied and with police escorts, back to China. But thousands more are still stranded in overcrowded makeshift camps, guarded by nervous soldiers from the same militia groups which once guarded the scam compounds but have now decided to release them. When asked, nearly all say they want to go home, but it still isn't happening.
Hello, Mike.
Hello.
Hi, Mike. This is Jonathan.
Food is limited and sanitation is appalling. I managed to speak to Mike, an Ethiopian, who was forced to work for a year in a scam compound.
The conditions we are in is very hard. We are sleeping on the floor. The toilets are very messed up by now. The food, they serve food twice a day, but the food is not sustaining us, not much. But we are not complaining about that at all. We just need to leave this place because we are suffering beyond comprehension, beyond comprehension. We just need to leave.
Mike's greatest fear is that if they're not allowed to cross over to Thailand soon, they'll be handed back to the Chinese scam bosses and punished as they were before.
It was very bad. It was the worst experience in my life. It was very bad, I swear. Of course, I have been beaten. I have been beaten. And believe me, I have seen a lot worse than this.
Thailand says it's going as fast as it can, but has limited capacity to screen everyone who comes over. Many of the freed workers are also getting little help from their own governments. They've often lost everything, even their passports.
Unfortunately, it seems we're in a bit of a standstill.
Judah Tanner runs an NGO which has spent years trying to help trafficked workers get out of Myanmar. He's alarmed by what he's hearing from the thousands like Mike, now out of the compounds, but still stuck on the other side of the border.
Unfortunately, we are hearing distressing information about lack of sanitation and toilets. We're understanding that one of the compounds that has about 400 people in it only has two bathrooms. A lot of them were actually screened for TB and were positive for TB. We're hearing from them that they're coughing up blood. Our worry is that we're not engaging fast enough.
So the place they showed us on the map is here.
Yeah, now I have the almost.
I met Aryan, a young Bangladeshi man who escaped from one of the most notorious scam compounds last October. It's very new. He showed me a short video he took of it, still under construction. He's come back to try to free 17 friends who are still over there.
Very hard life, like they will give you electric shock and you are crying and shouting. They have the target every week, $5,000. If no, give two electric shock.
Two electric shocks.
Yeah. Every week, we need to earn for them $5,000. I need to definitely fill up my target.
The Thai Prime Minister, Pettongtan Shinawat, has promised that her government is working hard to end the scourge of the scammers. But there's not yet any real sense of urgency here in Thailand about getting the freed workers out.
I just want to go home. I just want to go back to my country. That is all I'm asking.
Like Mike, they're still stuck in limbo between the horrors of the scam business they've just escaped and finding a way home.
Jonathan Head, reporting from the Thai-Myanmar border. This is NewsHour, coming to you on the BBC World Service. The online influencer and self-described misogynist Andrew Tate and his brother Tristan have arrived in the United States after Romanian prosecutors agreed to let them leave the country. The brothers had been arrested in Romania 3 years ago, and they still face a trial on allegations of rape, trafficking minors, and money laundering. The two men, who have U.S. passports, have been allowed to travel on condition they return to Romania for that trial. Speaking to reporters as he left Fort Lauderdale Airport in Florida, Andrew Tate again denied the allegations, insisting he and his brother were innocent.
I think my brother and I are largely misunderstood. There's a lot of opinions about us, a lot of things that go around about us on the internet. We've yet to be convicted of any crime in our lives ever. We have no criminal record anywhere on the planet ever. Our case was dismissed on the 19th of December in Romania under the Biden administration. And our prosecutor recently decided, because we have no active indictment in court, to let us go and return.
Matthew Jury is a lawyer representing British women who also say they were victims of the brothers' activities. Speaking to my colleague James Menendez, he claimed the U.S. government and Donald Trump had pressured Bucharest into releasing the brothers.
We all know how this works. We've all seen The Godfather. You know, you raise the issue and you expect results. And that's what the Trump administration does. I imagine they were explicit, but even if they weren't, the implication was very clear. Allow the Tates to leave or else.
Mr. Jury went on to say that he hoped the British Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, who's in Washington meeting Donald Trump, would push for the Tates' extradition so they would stand trial in a British court.
I would have thought the British government should be acting immediately and urgently to seek their extradition. We know that Starmer is in the US today with Trump. We know that he has, you know, a very busy agenda and that Ukraine is at the top of it. But I think it would be utterly remiss and an abdication of the UK government's responsibilities not to speak up for these women.
Ali Breland is a staff writer at The Atlantic who's written on Andrew Tate. I asked him what we know about the circumstances around the decision to let the Tate brothers return to the U.S.
Right now, some bits are like still a little unclear. We're trying to figure out like the totality of what happened. But sort of one of the most like sort of explicit bits is that a member of the Trump administration, Richard Grenell, was among the people who was like pushing to try to get the Tate's travel restrictions in Romania lifted. And this seems to be at least partially or largely at the impetus of the Trump administration deciding that they want to help the Tate brothers.
So the allegations seem fairly concrete to you that the Trump administration was involved in their release?
Yeah, I mean, the Financial Times reported that the Trump administration, through Special Envoy Grenell, had pressured the Romanian government to lift restrictions. Romania, I guess, like, is its own country, and they can do what they want. But these restrictions had been in place for a while, and then, you know, like, we're in the first Trump administration now. Grenell does this. The timing sort of lines up quite neatly.
And do we know anything about what Romania might get back in return?
That's a good question. It's a little bit unclear. I mean, like, there's a number of different things, like speculating, like it just might be an easy way to get the Trump administration off your back in the future. The Trump administration so far, and Donald Trump himself, has kind of shown that he's like willing to go after governments over very little. Canada hasn't really done anything to him or the United States, but he's sort of proactively and offensively going after Canada. Same thing with Greenland and Denmark.
And what do we think about the brothers and their need to go back to Romania for the trial?
Yeah, it's an interesting situation. Like, they have been accused of a lot of different things. They have been accused of multiple instances of sexual assault and rape. They've been accused of money laundering and trafficking. It's a very interesting decision because, like, you can kind of see the reaction even among people on the right in the United States is not uniformly a good one. In Florida, several officials tweeted that they, you know, would not stand for the Tate's type of behavior if they engaged in anything that they were accused of in Romania. So, yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting situation for the Tate's. And it's like, I understand why the Trump administration is interested in this, and we can get into that. But on some level, it is a little bit baffling.
I mean, can you tell me more about the Tate's former lawyer, Paul Ingrassia? What's his situation and his connections to the Trump administration?
Yeah, Paul Ingrassia is interesting. He worked with the firm that represented the Tates, and you know, he's publicly said that he's a very large fan of them. He kind of like occupied this weird position for a while and was sort of very on the margins, and then in the first Trump administration has come into a large role as the liaison between the Department of Justice and the White House. Ingrassia said that he's a fan of the Tate brothers. Ingrassia himself has sort of exhibited an interest in like very far right politics. CNN just reported that I think they found in old tweets where he said that he would support martial law to support Donald Trump. And he himself is a far right figure who is like also very willing to publicly support far right figures. He's like pleaded with Elon to unban Nick Fuentes, this sort of young far-right white nationalist, when Nick Fuentes was banned from Twitter. Fuentes has an account again, so it's not an issue anymore.
Ali Breland is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Now, let's bring you some more from that press conference between the US president and the British prime minister in Washington, D.C. Keir Starmer said that while the two leaders came from very different backgrounds, there are areas where they see eye to eye.
Mr. President, it's no secret we're from different political traditions, but there's a lot that we have in common. We believe it's not taking part that counts. What counts is winning. If you don't win, you don't deliver. And we're determined to deliver for the working people of Britain and America, who want and deserve to see their lives improve. So we're both in a hurry to get things done. And that's what the UK and US do when we work together. We win and we get things done.
Donald Trump has also suggested that a US-UK trade deal was in the works and would be reached fairly quickly. He was asked by a journalist whether that meant Keir Starmer had convinced him not to place tariffs on British goods.
He tried. He was working hard, I'll tell you that. He earned whatever the hell they pay him over there. But he tried. I think there's a very good chance that in the case of these two great friendly countries, I think we could very well end up with a real trade deal where the tariffs wouldn't be necessary. We'll see. But he earned whatever they pay him. He earned today. He was working hard at lunch, and I'm very receptive to it. I think we, in all fairness, in all seriousness, I think we have a very good chance at arriving at a very good deal.
Well, that's all from us for now on NewsHour. You can see a lot more on the meeting and the varied press conference afterward at the BBC News website. We have a live page running that's offering ongoing analysis. But from me, Celia Hatton, and the rest of the team at NewsHour, thanks for listening.
This podcast is sponsored by Wise, the app for doing things in other currencies. If you're sending or spending money abroad, you should use Wise. You'll have up to 40 currencies in the palm of your hand. Wise gives you the real exchange rate, which means you'll spend less on fees and more of your money gets where you need it to be. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. T's and C's apply.